Accession number 27185, reel 42.
Major Barras, reel 42. You were saying that you didn't want to carry the flowers.
No, well, it was going to be very difficult, so I suggested he put them back in the... put them in a vase in the mess so that everybody there could enjoy them. I thanked him, of course, very much, and thanked them for their excellent service and one thing and another. Of course, they all spoke English, you see. Or we only took on people, obviously, who could speak English. Yeah. I don't think all of them spoke brilliant English. I mean, some of the waitresses knew enough English to understand what we were saying, and when it came to food and so, one or two things. But I doubt whether they could sit down for very long and talk about the international situation. Anyway, I was, of course, now I was had to revert to substantive captain. I was down to captain now, having gallivanted around as a bogus major since 1944, temporary major. I was now a captain, and of course I had to, before I came, not only did I have to take my crown down and put three pips up, I of course had to change my badges. So I put the Bedfords, I got hold of some Bedford badges. I don't know where I got them from, because I got them all done before I left.
Did they have a regimental tailor in London? Presumably they did.
I suppose I must have. We all have regimental tailors. I suppose I got the flashes and everything and put them on, which, in fact, I never thought about it, actually, but it was when it turned out to be a good diplomatic move as far as they were concerned. I didn't do it for that reason. I just did it because I knew was going to have to do it sometime. So I was probably more warmly received because I was dressed as a Bedford when I got there than I would normally have happened. So I was posted as a second in command to a company, infantry company, under a chap called Major Lucas, who was soon to go home. As a matter of fact, the Bedfords had, like all the other regular regiments, amalgamated with their second battalions the previous year, in 1948, and same way as the Essex did and all the others. So I was, when he went, when Major Lucas went, I was given command of the company. Because although there were some majors there hanging around, which was the result of the amalgamation, which I mentioned earlier, but some of them were waiting to go home. There was a funny sort of end of term feeling about the battalion when I got there. And I mean, it's not for me to make any criticisms at all about another regiment. I don't like doing it, but They were very good. The discipline was good. They got a good hard core of regular warrant officers and sergeants and senior corporals. But I think they were like a lot of regiments at that time. They weren't quite sure what the purpose was. The war was over. A lot of people were waiting for demob still. and the previous commanding officer was known as Bonzo. I do know his name, but I won't mention it. And everybody, I remember, were talking of Bonzo's days when I was there. Right, I haven't seen you for donkey's years. They haven't seen you for Bonzo's years, sort of thing was going on. And they were all talking about Bonzo's days. He left, of course, soon after I got there, so I didn't know him very well. But I think he was coming to the end of his tenure as well. I don't think he got any promotion after he left. So it was sort of a little bit frayed at the edges, perhaps, but still the discipline held up well, and that was good.
Discipline is one thing, and enthusiasm is another.
Well, that's right, yes. There was a definite lack of purpose, I think. Now, of course, Dennis Roster was just the chap to generate the whole place back again on its feet.
How did he go about doing that? What were his methods?
Well, he just took a grip. Now, the first thing he did to me as company commander was to send me up in the hills with my company. And he said, go up into the hills near, we were near the Yugoslav border, actually, with old Tito on the other side, rattling his sword. That's why we were there, of course. And I was up there for, I think it was at least 2 weeks, we had a tented camp up there. And we did exercises. And we started, Fred, doing some platoon exercises and then platoon exercises, and I did some company exercises. Now, at this stage, we were getting our first national service soldiers. And the policy was to take them in and not treat them like anything else but regular soldiers. So they understood right from the very start. And they lapped it up, the majority of them. I don't remember any, as far as I was concerned, I don't remember any many problems, and there probably obviously were. I mean, there were chaps there who called off jobs which they were doing and was keen on and were going to have a tremendous drop in income. The ones who just got married and had to leave their wives behind, although there weren't many of those because they were young fellows. So there were one or two who were in the middle of their education at university and that sort of thing, but I think they were, I don't think they took them. I think they were allowed just to finish.
I think they could defer if they wanted to.
Yes, they could, yes.
The option.
Yes, that's
so
true.
Presumably if they were serving, it was their choice.
Yeah. But after we'd been up there for, I don't know, we were there like 2 weeks, I put them out into the, we went out into the wilds and didn't come back and sleep in tents at night. They slept out in the open and a lot of rain, I remember. And by the time we'd finished up there, because at the end of every exercise I got them all together, which was a practice, of course, to go through what was done and whether we could have done any better. And they were allowed to chip in if they wanted to. And then get them back to their tents and so on, totally cleaned up, clean their rifles, get them all spick and span again. And after 2 weeks, they were becoming men. I mean, they were boys when they came in, but they were becoming together. They were getting what's called bonded these days, I suppose. Together, the section leaders were getting more confidence because they'd been given responsibility in the field. Platoon commanders were the same thing. And I think even after 2 weeks when we went back to barracks, the company was much more efficient and the morale was much higher.
What time of year was this?
This was April.
So it must have been quite
April,
cold.
May. It must have been April, May, I suppose. So it wasn't hot yet, really.
What was the ground
Salonika.
Like?
You see, we were at Salonika.
Yes. What was the terrain like there?
Hilly. Very hilly. We were just at the foot of the mountains there. In fact, I can remember going up myself on one occasion when we were doing nothing in particular, walking to the top of a nearby hill. And it was getting dark. And I looked down on the camp with the little lights there. And the marquee, which was the nafe or the canteen, and I could hear a voice floating up, doing "housey housey," calling out numbers, top of the shop, like this one, legs 11, and so forth. And then I thought of the brutal and licentious British soldier down there with his pint of beer, and all he was interested in was putting numbers on cards. And over the border was with the communists, with all their threats and so forth. And I thought, well, Britain's answer to the communist threat, because the Russians were obviously behind what Tito was doing, up to a point, although Tito, of course, was very independent. But that was off duty. But this thought went through my mind, you know, how humane the British soldier is and can be. The other thing I saw up from up top of a hill, I remember, looking down on the sea, because you could see the sea from there, was the battleship Vanguard, which came in. Beautiful sight, lovely lines, anchored out. In fact, I was lucky enough to get an invitation to go to a cocktail party aboard later and shown over the ship.
Was she out there for an exercise or for any other purpose?
No, just showing the flag. But of course she was also showing Tito that we had ships around as well, obviously.
Fairly massive firepower, Vanguard.
Yes, oh, she was a beautiful ship. I wish they'd, one ship they could have restored and kept, because she was the last.
The last battleship?
Yeah. I don't think she ever fired a shot in anger, actually. But it, several years later, she was taken off the Knacker's Yard, and that was it. So, whilst I was up there, I got a note from Dennis Rossiter, which said, would I like to become his adjutant? So I felt very honoured and wrote back and said, yes, I'd be delighted. But I did it with certain trepidation, because I wasn't one of them, so to speak. I was a guinea pig at that time. It's not like it is today. Another officer serving in another regiment was not unique, but it was unusual.
But you were staff trained.
Staff trained, yes, but I wasn't a Bedford. Yeah. And there could have been a lot of resentment around the place. I mean, he was taking a hell of a risk, actually. Of not having a Bedford as the adjutant, because after all, the adjutant is the CEO's chief of staff, and he's probably one of the most, he is the most powerful person in the battalion after the CO in many ways, because he issues all the orders on behalf of the CO. He may issue orders which he doesn't even get from the CO, because he knows the CO, that's what the CO wanted. So you have to strike a balance between that and keeping your good relationships outside with the company commanders who are senior to you. I always made a point of calling them sir, because they were majors and I was now a captain. And you also have to be very careful not to let it go to your head and think you're the commanding officer, because that was absolutely fatal.
How did they respond to this?
Appointment? Well, the only two playback, they were very good. Dennis Ruster was, as I said, a very kind, humane man, and he was very supportive as far as I was concerned. And I think he must have got the word out to everybody to lay off, sort of thing, not to get worked up about it. But the only two occasions which came to my notice, one was when we were back in the UK, Dennis Ruster came to me one day after he'd seen the colonel of the regiment and said, it's no use, he won't see you. So it was obviously the colonel of the regiment took umbrage that they hadn't got a Bedford as an adjutant. And the other person was the ordinary room sergeant. Just as I was leaving, and we'd got on exceedingly well. There was no problems between us at all. He was an old... what's the name of the orphanage? Well-known.
Bernardo's.
He was an old Bernardo's boy. And there were quite a number of them I came across in the army, and they were excellent. Well-disciplined and reliable and loyal. And just so we're leaving, he was kind enough to say he thought I'd done the job all right, but he said he would have preferred a Bedford. But then, of course, he, being a, as he was, the regiment was his whole life. I don't think he had a family. And, you know, the regiment he'd been with, he was quite a senior soldier.
What about the warrant officers? How did you get on with them?
Oh, no problem. I had no problem with them at all. The RSM himself had come from the Coldstream, but he'd been a Bedford for some time. I mean, he didn't come in outside. I think he'd been a Bedford from the start of the war. This is what happened. I had, when I was battalion IO in 1940, after we got back from Dunkirk, I had a sergeant, my intelligence sergeant, Sergeant Higgs, was Coldstream. And I think what happened was a lot of these guys couldn't be absorbed, were called up, couldn't be absorbed into their parent regiments, and were therefore called up and put in their county regiments, because there were too many of them.
I know there was a lot of cross-posting during the war, because it was necessary for reasons of battle casualties and so on, but of course in wartime it's different.
Yeah.
And this is effectively peacetime.
Yeah, but this has happened before, you see, I'm sure this goes back to 1940.
Yes.
Where mobilisation took place. Mm. These reservists were called up, and instead of going to their parent regiments, who obviously couldn't absorb them for some reason or other at that time, they went to their local county regiments.
Now, apart from the fact that you just weren't one of them,
yeah,
and you were solidly Essex.
Yeah.
Did you find that they had different ways of thinking about things, different ways of doing things, the ways in which you would have done them if you'd been still with the Essex Regiment?
I don't think so. Of course, their background was different because most of them had the Burma Star. They had been in the Chindits.
Yes.
And the chap I took over from, fellow called Ian Ross, Captain Ian Ross, had got a military cross during the Chindits campaign. I think I was told he was got the military cross for holding off the enemy at the end of a runway, whilst the rest of the battalion, fag end of the battalion, was embarking an aircraft taking off, and he held the Japs off whilst they were doing that, and he must have got away himself. Well, he obviously got away himself in the end. Last thing I heard of him, he was in New Zealand as a lieutenant colonel, where he was doing lay reading, and he died quite early. That was about 10 years ago, I think. I read about it in the regimental magazine.
Second bench has actually been in Italy for some of the time as well.
Yes. I don't know which battalion it was. Well, it must have been the first battalion that was in the. Yes, it was, because they were then in India.
Yeah.
They were in Tobruk as well during the war, I believe.
They were.
First at Bedfords.
Yeah. But you were saying that the 2nd Battalion had more or less been absorbed.
Oh, 2nd Battalion had been merged into the 1st and become the 1st, yeah. Most of them there I don't think many of them could have been in North Africa, because I don't remember seeing any Africa Stars amongst them. I mean, certainly Dennis Ruster had the Burma Star. The company commanders, I remember, most of them had the Burma Star. And then they, as I say, went to India, and then they came to Greece, where the amalgamation took place.
You were saying that the Yugoslavs were across the border at this stage, and that they were making threatening noises. Did you see anything of the Yugoslav?
No, not a bit, nothing at all. In fact, it was the threat was beginning to fade a bit then. In fact, the Suffolk, the brigade was 2nd Infantry Brigade, which we were in Salonika. We had the 1st Royal Ulster Rifles and the 1st Suffolk with us. The brigade commander was one Brigadier Splosh Jones, he was known as, a sapper. Now, the last I heard of him was that he was a general, Major General, I think, but he was chairman of the British Legion for some time. That was some time ago now. Anyway, the Suffolk were taken away and ordered to go to... not the Royal Ulster Rifles. It was the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. The 43rd. It's 43rd and 52nd, isn't it, their regiments? Well, they were left with the 43rd at that time. So it was the 43rd that were there, and the 1st Suffolk. And the 1st Suffolk left us to go to Malaya. And we had to exchange. We took on their older serving people whose overseas tours were soon going to come to an end, and replaced them with some of our longer leased people, so that when they went to Malaya they'd have a battalion full of people who wouldn't be leaking home. So they left, but they weren't replaced. So we were left with 2 battalions there. So that's an indication of how the tell you how the garrison was running down. But before the 43rd, there were the East Surreys. The East Surreys were there when I first arrived. Yeah, sorry, it's coming back to me now. The East Surreys were there when I first arrived. They left soon after I got there and were replaced by the 43rd. The East Surreys, I think, went down to Athens. And then we were left, the two of us, the 43rd and the 1st Bedfords. Mind you, of course, the Bedfords are Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire regiment. And there was always a bit of a thing about what they called themselves. They were the 16th of foot, and they were very proud of the fact that they had a fairly senior number in the
low number, yes.
And that they'd been, and of course, one of their biggest battle honours was Blenheim. They shortened, they didn't like being called Beds and Hearts, for obvious reasons. They didn't like, well, the official abbreviation, so far as the army was concerned, was called Beds Hearts. BDFS Hearts, but he couldn't call them that. So they called themselves the Bedfords. I don't know what the people of Hertfordshire thought of that, but they, of course, had their own territorial battalions.
What about the internal situation in Greece when you arrived? Was there still any hint of a threat from the...
There was not very much. There were guerrillas around the place.
They were?
Guerrilla bands. Mm. But the civil war, of course, had ended soon after Churchill went there. You may recall he went there Christmas, whatever it was, I can't remember the year now. And Damaskinos was the archbishop who put in charge as regent, wasn't it? Until, what was it, George II came back as king, and he died. And then, of course, King Paul was on the throne when we were there. But I think the Civil War pretty well petered out then, because we poured in a lot of soldiers after that. The Paras went in to cleaned up Athens. And then the garrison was increased considerably. But it was a pretty nasty business, the Civil War. But they got over it. Apart from the sort of, there were guerrillas around the place, which was sort of fag end of the Civil War, really. They got weapons and...
Did you get involved in operations against...
No, it wasn't our business. What, in fact, we were there really waiting whilst the Greek army was being reformed and trained, and that we were undertaking, not us, but the British army,
yes,
in various parts of Greece.
Did you see any Greek troops?
No, I don't remember. They didn't. You see, we were confined. The Salonika garrison, which consisted more than the infantry brigade. I mean, there were sappers and other people there. I can't remember if there was any artillery there or not. But we were confined to a 10-mile radius. We weren't allowed to go out of that area because this was an arrangement, obviously, being made with the Greeks. They didn't want us wandering all over the countryside, and it wasn't necessarily safe to do so. That was one of the problems, but we didn't have any problem. The only time they ever went out was on leave or duck shooting, which was a big lake near the Yugoslav border, which you could get special permission to go and shoot up there. I didn't go.
What was the condition of Salonika itself?
Well, it was very run down. I don't think it had been damaged at all. Of course, it's a port. There wasn't an awful lot to do there. I mean, there were tavernas, which were quite pleasant, and we could go out and eat. Any Greek with initiative, whether he was mending bicycles or selling hats, had turned his shop into a eating place for soldiers, with notices outside saying, "Tommy, eggs and chips," which was sort of magnet as far as British soldier was concerned. So a lot of them went into that business. And they were very friendly at that stage. They were very friendly indeed, because a lot of them realised that they owed their independence to us. Because if we hadn't been there, the communists would have been there. Mm. And there was always a danger. I mean, Churchill always recognised the danger that could easily spread along the northern coast of the Mediterranean to Italy, which was a bit shaky at that time too. So they were very grateful. The ones I met were always very, very friendly. They all had silver teeth, I remember, when they smiled. We used to beat retreat, to send the band and drums out to beat retreat in the surrounding villages, and they all turned out and watched. And whether it was they were doing it because they wanted to see it, or good manners, I don't know, but they seemed to enjoy it. So our relationships with them, our relationship with the locals was good.
What sort of training were you doing? Was it basic infantry training?
Yes, basically infantry training. The barracks we were in, we were stationed in old Greek cavalry barracks, they were called. But it was in a very disintegrated state. What had happened, we'd built a previous battalion who had been there, I don't know who they were, or even before them, had Nissen huts put in open spaces, because there was a lot of open space there. They obviously pulled down a lot of old buildings, put in Nissen huts. And there was still open space around the place. It looked like bits of London which had been bombed and cleared. There was one house left which was used as battalion headquarters, and in there was stationed the orderly room, CO's office, my office, second in command. RSM had an office there, and I think that was about it. It was quite a small place.
What sort of level?
And the training you were asking about.
Yes.
Yeah, we did. Well, I was giving you the background of our situation, because it showed what we were living in. Our training was limited to what we could do inside the barracks. Earlier on, I remember when we got there, which was obviously individual training,
yes.
Weapon training, a certain amount of drill, I suppose, camouflage, lectures, hygiene, all kinds of things like that. We could go out and do exercises in the countryside roundabout, and it worked up to company exercises, and we did some battalion exercises, I remember, because I remember going out as adjutant in the battalion headquarters, and there were battalion exercises set by brigade. Having a sapper as a brigade commander did, I know, set Dennis Rossiter a certain amount of problem, because you see, sappers, rather unkindly, we used to refer to them as plumbers, which wasn't fair, because they did have plumbers, and they did have bricklayers and all kinds of things, but they also had people who did the most dangerous jobs in the world, of going out in the front line with mines and Bangalore torpedoes and all kind of clearing mines and all kinds of things like that. So probably plumbers wasn't fair, but he was a sapper, and of course sappers' work was more of a science. You built a bridge, you laid mines, and you made a note of where they were. You got the book out, and you did everything according to the book. No doubt, of course, at times sappers in certain situations didn't act by the book, and they were caught in difficult situations and had to use their heads. But infantry, on the other hand, there is an element of science and bookwork, but it's more of an art.
Yes.
Because every situation you come across is different, and you have to work it out and work your operation and your action out according to the best way you can see of getting over a certain situation you're confronted with. So I think old Splosh Jones expected us to behave more like sappers than infantrymen, and to get everything buttoned up, tied down and tidy. And of course you can't.
He wanted it done according to the manual then?
Well, yes. I think he expected us to, you know.
That must have created...
I don't say he did it all the time. I think he understood, you know. But I got the impression when Rossiter, Dennis, came back from conferences with him that... there had been some certain amount of disagreement.
Had views been exchanged?
Yes. So he used to come back and sigh and take his hat off and throw it on the desk and so. But he was very kind. He never sort of unburdened himself on me too much. But he did once or twice or say, you know, it's very difficult.
What kind of things were you practicing on these higher level exercises?
Well, it was the usual things. I mean, advance to contact, defence. I don't know whether we ever did a withdrawal or not. But it was initially to practice the NCOs and platoon commanders to manage their